IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy, a flagship daily public policy podcast of Takshashila Institution. I'm your host for the day, Amit Kumar, a research analyst with the Takshashila Institution's Indo-Pacific Studies program. And I'm joined by Mr. Manoj Keval Ramani, fellow China Studies and chair Indo-Pacific States Studies program, a seasoned China watcher. Welcome, Manoj.
Thanks, Amit. Good to be here.
And today we thought we'll talk about the two big events that concluded in China last week, namely the China Development Forum that concluded on 22nd of March and Boao Forum for Asia Conference that was held between 26th and 29th of March. Two back-to-back events hosted by China in China straight after the two sessions, right? So Manoj, before we dive into the signals that came out of these two sessions and these two conferences, could you please tell our listeners a little bit about what these two events mean? Why are they held at this time of the year?
Hey, so very briefly, the China Development Forum is also, both of these are annual forums, and both of them have been going on for a very, very long time. The China Development Forum is essentially something that's held with foreign businesses visiting China. This is held by the Development Research Center of the State Council. This is the think tank of the State Council, which is sort of the cabinet of the Chinese government. And the objective here is essentially to have foreign business heads and Chinese business heads get together. It's usually something that the premier leads because the premier has conventionally been in charge of the economy. And the idea is that you get these business organizations and their heads together and talk about economic opportunities, cut deals, and so on and so forth. So it's usually really useful because you get certain kinds of messaging around what are the government's economic priorities, how are they going to go about them. And the fact that this is held after the two sessions allows these foreign CEOs to essentially come in and figure out what all the jargon during the two sessions has meant and where the direction of the economy is going. The Boao Forum for Asia, on the other hand, that is a distinct sort of NGO, non-profit organization that's been created. There are many countries that have come together to create it. So about 25 countries that come together to create it along with Australia. This has been, again, the BFA sort of conference has been going on for many, many years. I think the formation of this grouping was in some 20 odd years ago. So it's been quite some time. I don't remember the exact year. And the idea is, again, that as China becomes a much more increasingly global actor, you have a forum which looks at Asian issues with China sort of being at the heart of it. So usually at the BFA, what you get is more sort of political speeches in comparison to the China Development Forum. We've had Xi Jinping address this forum on quite a few occasions. In fact, the Global Security Initiative, which Xi Jinping launched, was launched at the Boao Forum for Asia in 2022. So it's an important forum in that sense. Also, this year, Xi Jinping did not address the forum. So one is an economic forum to sort of get an understanding for economic policies and talk to foreign CEOs. The other is a more sort of political forum, which has different aspects of it, but it's an Asia-focused forum.
Yeah, Manoj, you stole my line. I was supposed to use this in my latter half of the podcast. But okay, let's begin with this context. Let's come to China Development Forum. So this year, the theme was the continuous development of China, right? And even saw participation, as you mentioned, from heads and attendees from major multilateral institutions and businesses, right? And we saw Li Chang speak to Ajay Banga, president of World Bank, and Kristalina Georgieva, managing director of IMF. And in the meeting, Kristalina seemed quite optimistic of China's growth potential, right? And the sentiment was also echoed by the president of Asian Development Bank. The expectation was that China will completely meet the GDP target that it set earlier this year. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think this optimism was rightly placed, or do you think China will find it hard to meet this target?
Yeah, look, I don't think we should read too much into a statement that has been reported by largely the Chinese state media about optimism among global leaders. If you want to understand what the World Bank and the IMF genuinely think, I think it's worth going back to their annual assessments. And subsequently in the year, you'll see these assessments being revised as the year evolves. And what we saw last year in terms of the annual assessments that were put out, they were nowhere close to 5%, right? So they were all well below 5%. So I'm not entirely sure that, in a realistic sense, this number will be met. That said, what we have seen is that we have seen the last 2 months lead to an improvement in the Chinese economy. So there has been, you have seen some policy signals that came out of the two sessions, and we discussed those. Some of those are around long-term bonds. Some of those are around increased spending. But the spending increase is not substantial enough to justify, if you compare it to the year before, to justify this change in terms of GDP growth. Also, we're not necessarily seeing consumption pick up in the way that one would have expected thus far. But that said, there has been an improvement if you look at the numbers of the first 2 months of this year. So if you look at the numbers, what they will tell you is that retail sales went up by 5.5% year on year. Total value added of industrial enterprises has increased. In fact, just the March, PPI has gone up above 50. So anything above 50 means an expansion in manufacturing activity. Anything below 50 means a contraction. And I think the March number for Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, was around 50.8%. So that means that finally, after 5 or 6 months, there has been some degree of expansion that's happening in terms of manufacturing activity. If you look at investment for the first 2 months, you will see that investment in manufacturing, particularly high-tech manufacturing, continues to rise. If you look at fixed asset investment across the board, for the first 2 months, it increased by about 4.2%. If you remove real estate from this, you will see that fixed asset investment increased by about 8.9%. So real estate continues to remain a weak spot in the economy. So generally, if you see, numbers tend to be tending towards in the right direction for Beijing. Even the inflation number tended to be moving in the right direction, although there needs to be a lot more change. The official target for CPI for the year is 3%. But for the first 2 months, it's been hovering around 0.7-0.8%, which is better than what it was, but it is still, it's not like a vote of confidence in the economy. So it remains to be seen whether actually these targets of growth of about 5% will be met. Beijing seems to be messaging that, look, this is a realistic target and we will be meeting this thing. In fact, in the People's Daily, there was a very lengthy article which talked about the fact that why this target is completely realistic and why this is an important target to be set, because it is consistent with the country's medium and long-term development goals. And the reason that we are setting this target is because you need a reasonable growth rate also to be able to achieve high-quality development. So the indication is that you need to have that. And again, that piece went on into consumption, investment, trade again, which has been a positive, foreign trade particularly. So the argument is that, yes, we are on track to meet the target. I don't necessarily buy the idea, because there's lots more that needs to happen, particularly from a consumption perspective. But we'll wait and see over the next few months, and we'll wait and see what the IMF and World Bank do in their actual estimations as they review their estimations down the year, rather than what is said at some forum, or far be it said, what is repeated in Chinese media without attributing direct quotation.
But my only contention is that most of the stats that you just quoted resemble the supply side changes, and which actually were quite similar even during the previous year. But what we saw essentially was that the demand was not picking up, even though supply side, China did not see any trouble on the supply side. And a connected question to that, for the past 2 years or so, China has been highlighting that there's a need to shift to new drivers of the economy. And this theme also made its way into this forum as well, wherein China committed that not only look towards opening up, but what it'll also do is that it'll look towards new drivers of economy, essentially relying more on high technology and innovation to drive its economy. Do you think China being able to make this transition smoothly? And if at all it does, do you think it can actually go on to replace the old drivers of China's economy?
So the answer to the last part of your question, whether I think that they can replace the old drivers of the economy, I think that's what they're trying, right? And it's quite evident that that's what they're trying. And just that stat that I shared with you on the shift in investment away from the property sector to and in favor of manufacturing is an indicator of how much the effort is in that direction. Now, whether they are able to achieve that while ensuring that there is enough demand side stimulus, which is where the problem is, like you pointed out, is, you know, it's a long-term process. It's not going to be a short-term process. So, you know, the answer to that would be, we'll have to wait and see as far how much pain can you continue to deal with yourself as government and how much you can spend. Also, how much pain can society deal with and can you maintain the demand, particularly as, say, property values continue to decline, and because of that, the wealth of people continues to decline because a lot of people have invested and stored wealth in property. And as that value declines, you end up in a position where you're not sure, so you don't necessarily spend as much more and you feel poorer. At the same time, is your employment much more secure? Now, the property market is not just a space for people's investment, but is also a significant source of employment. If, you know, across the board, developers continue to remain very weak and employment continues to remain very weak, and this is not just about construction of buildings, there's a whole other ecosystem that is related to it, from contractors to furniture to appliances to everything, right? It has an entire set of downstream implications. So what does that do to employment? Can people shift employment? And if you can't do that easily and there is tremendous uncertainty, then can you continue to ensure that there is demand-side support for your new manufacturing goals if people are suspicious and don't feel like spending? So I think it's sort of a vicious cycle that they found themselves in. It's by no means a cycle that you can't escape, but it's going to be a painful escape which will have political implications. And can the party withstand those political implications is the key question. To me, what the signals that we are getting even after the two sessions and even from, you know, the China Development Forum and subsequently, one of the key signals is that, yes, we are going to continue down this path and this is a decided path that we have taken and we are not going to waver from it. I'll give you an example for this. When Li Qiang, when he spoke at the China Development Forum, he basically made the case that, look, we are going to be doing this. We are going to be focusing on constructing this modern industrial system. You know, when it comes to demand side, we're going to try and support demand through, you know, new urbanization, equipment renewal, trading of consumer goods, and so on and so forth, along with, you know, the creation of a green transformation of industry, focusing on green lifestyles, which can give, you know, emphasis to new products such as, say, new energy vehicles, electric vehicles, and so on and so forth. But it wasn't really talking about any of the old drivers. So the messaging was that, look, we are on a road to recovery and this will be a long one while we are going to try to keep shifting our economic model. And there is no sort of returning to the old format. Another person who sort of emphasized this message was the director of the NDRC, who's Zhang Shanjie, who basically said that, look, the economy's progress over the last year or so has been like going uphill, a rolling stone sort of climbing up the hill and overcoming obstacles and things like that. So, yes, very poetic, but his idea was basically the same, that it's going to be a long process, which is going to be led by industrial and technological innovation. And we are going to be focusing on that primarily, but we're not going back to what the old model was. Whether they succeed is a matter of political will at the end of the day. And so far, it seems like they're sticking by it.
Yeah.
In terms of even the real estate, the new systems that have been set into place to try and provide funding to real estate projects, there has been some progress on this, but they have stuck to that model and it's not been a free flowing of liquidity to all real estate companies. So we'll have to wait and see how this plays out. It's a little early, but we'll have to wait and see. But the signal is that they will stick it out.
Yeah, I agree. And just adding on to that, I think the problem, it is just not political, but there are practical considerations as well. I mean, to me, it seems like because the effort is to move away from speculation to productive forces. And there's, although even though they have outlined what those productive forces mean, there's not a lot of clarity as to, and further clarity as to what those, where do they want this growth, new growth to come from? And if the focus is on new disruptive technologies and breakthrough technologies, the problems are twofold, right? One, that there are the investment. Already China was investing a lot in this segment, and this investment cannot be as much that it could finally go on to replace the kind of growth that it was getting from real estate or other sectors. And second, there's a segment of wastefulness even in the innovation sector. You don't always get the yield and the results of the money that you put in, right? So this problem on that front as well. But yeah, anyway, so
I probably disagree to some. I mean, I don't think you've captured all of the elements. I don't think I disagree, but I don't think you've captured all the elements. So when they talk about this building of a modern industrial system, the innovation aspect or this, you know, new productive forces and the quality upgradation, there is just one aspect of it in which you're talking about emerging technology and industries. That's just one part of this puzzle. The others are that you need to ensure that traditional industries that you were operating. So that means that you're not giving up other kinds of manufacturing. You're saying we need to upgrade the model by which that is done. So whether that means by digitization, whether that means by ensuring that perhaps the use of more robotics, you know. So you essentially are trying to improve total factor productivity through the infusion of technology. And that is the key part of it. Now, that can be done with traditional industry, that can be done with modern industry, or that can be done by just digitizing certain things, building better connections, and so on and so forth. And what they're saying is that we will do all of this. And therefore, all of this comes under new productive forces, because essentially we need to add a technological component to how we were doing manufacturing so that the scale increases, the speed increases, the quality increases, and overall productivity increases. Which is basically what their argument is as they go up the value chain, where you're moving away from labor, or at least a heavy reliance on labor. Sure. I don't think that need, I mean, the gains from that need not be as long-term, or the gains from each of these need not be as long-term. I agree, you know, gains from certain kinds of breakthroughs in biotechnologies or semiconductors or any of that stuff will be long-term. But you can do digitization of traditional industries to improve process flows.
Yeah.
And to make it quicker, you know, so or you can do mechanization of certain, you know, labor intensive practice in the past, such as say in agriculture, to increase productivity. So I think that is what they're largely looking at.
Yeah, I agree. Process and product innovation. My only concern was, would process innovation be able to compensate for the growth that it will lose from diverting from the speculation and other sectors?
But in that he's saying, right, that I don't necessarily, I mean, I think that they have internalized the fact that they are no longer going to be growing at 7-8%. And, you know, so that I think they've accepted that growth is going to slow down. And in fact, they argue that it's good for growth to slow down. We are now too large.
Okay. So now we have talked about CTF. Let's move on to BOA. So if CTF, as you rightly pointed out at the beginning of the podcast, that it was about economic signaling or economic platform, BOA was much more political and strategic. And it's interesting to see, because just days before, Chinese leaders were trying to boost Western businesses, and days later, they were back to taking shots at the Americans and their rivals, right? So to begin with, as you pointed out at, again at the beginning, that BOA has been here for the last nearly about two decades now, and it has seen participation from regional leaders, government officials, business executives, and scholars from Asia and all around the world. Do you think it is becoming a prominent platform for the congregation of Asian states now, which is at the China-led platform? And what place does it hold in China's ambition to be the sole country to lead Asia?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is one of the premier forums every year that Beijing holds. And it is a pulpit that allows China to sort of articulate its vision for Asia and the world. I mean, I don't think it is any secret anymore that, and if somebody thinks that what I'm saying is not borne out by facts, then they need to do far more research, because it is no secret that what Beijing is looking to do, despite whatever it may say, is to displace the United States as the preponderant power in Asia to begin with. Now, whether that leads to a global contention, that's another matter. But at least in Asia, Beijing is very, very clear that it wants to be the preponderant power, and it wants to have a certain unipolarity. Or if not unipolarity in the hierarchy of states, it wants to be at the top, particularly in Asia. And I think repeatedly at the BOA Forum of Asia, we've seen this sentiment articulated. And this year also, you had Chawla Ji, who is the chairman of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, one of the Politburo Standing Committee members. He delivered the keynote speech. Forum was themed Asia and the World, Common Challenges, Shared Responsibilities. And what Chaw basically spoke about was, you know, that look, China's answer to the world is this idea of a community of common destiny for mankind. Under this are the four key pillars, which is BRI, GDI, GSI, and GCI. And then he basically makes points around each of these, in where he's basically arguing that, look, the Asia needs not zero-sum competition and power politics and block confrontation, but it needs an accommodation of the needs and interests of everybody. And it must implement GSI because GSI represents that. One key phrase, which again, not new, Xi Jinping talked about this very early on a decade ago when he took power, was the need for Asia to be for Asians. And he repeats this when he says that we must keep in our own hands the future of lasting peace and security in Asia. So basically, he's classifying the US in particular as an extra-regional power. I wonder if this is also meant for Russia, whether Russia is also seen as an extra-regional power, because Beijing seems to have no problem drilling with Russia in Asia, but it has a problem with American presence in Asia. So that is, again, a message that is continues to articulate. It continues to articulate the message that China is an opportunity for the region and its arguments are the right way forward. These are not unilateralist. These are creating, quote-unquote, an equal and multipolar world order, which, again, I don't think those words comport with Beijing's actions. Sure. But that's essentially, this is a forum where Beijing makes its foreign policy proclamations and the messaging is very clear for anybody who wants to read what China's intentions are when it comes to Asia and potentially the world.
Right. And the theme that they had for this conference this year was Asia and the World, Common Challenges, Shared Responsibility. And they did press on the need for peace and unity and cooperation and rebuilding confidence and trust, etc. And all this while, you have a war going on in a certain part of Asia where Israel and Palestine and Hamas are in loggerheads. And given that this is one of the objectives that China repeatedly tries to project, how serious do you see a stakeholder has China been? Let alone other conflicts that are occurring in other parts of the world, but at least conflicts that are occurring in Asia, especially the one in Israel and Palestine. How serious a stakeholder do you see China as in this dynamics?
Yeah, look, China's engagement with the Israel-Hamas conflict, it's clearly taken a side in the conflict, and it's taken the side of Palestine and the Arab states, and I don't think it has necessarily been terribly constructive. I think it has approached this conflict in the context of China's rivalry with the United States, and that sense of strategic competition. And therefore, it's basically engaged in the kind of... China's position is very understandable given China's overall interests in terms of stability, in terms of energy trade with Arab states. And it's, it had significant engagement with Israel, but its overall economic and security engagement with the Arab states and its concerns in that regard are far deeper and far greater with the Arab states. So you can see why it has taken that position, particularly in the context of the US position on the issue. Now, I think that over the past 6 months of this conflict, China's position has held it in good stead to the extent that, yes, the conflict has not been resolved, but it has been able to extract some degree of concession, say, from the Houthis, although apparently even then there was an attack on Chinese interests. But it has been able to extract that sort of concession. It has been able to project the Biden administration's shift at the UN Security Council, where a resolution was recently passed and adopted with US abstention, which essentially was calling for a ceasefire. If you recall, much of the West, including the Biden administration, was loath to use the word ceasefire for a very long period of time. I think that it will argue that its position has held it in good stead, and it will argue that its position has been fundamentally on the issue of peace, whether you agree or disagree with them. But what is the outcome of that is that it has obviously alienated Israel deeply, and I think that's a loss that is calculated, and they've been willing to accept that loss. I think if you want to really see whether China is a peaceful stakeholder or a stakeholder that is interested in peaceful outcomes in Asia, it's really worth seeing videos of what Chinese Coast Guard vessels are doing with Filipino vessels in the South China Sea. I think that tells you a lot about peace. It's also really worth seeing what China has been doing with India along the border over the last 4 years. It tells you a lot about how China thinks about exercising power and the role of peaceful negotiations in settling disputes. Peace is valuable, but on Beijing's terms and on terms when Beijing believes it is in an advantageous situation and position. So I don't think that necessarily this is, I mean, I don't buy all this, obviously, arguments for peaceful development and peaceful rise. You know, China under Xi Jinping is far more aggressive. It's far more assertive. It's far more willing to use force. It's far less risk averse, but it's not necessarily interested in engaging in all out conflict and war. It is interested in using force in some ways intelligently so that they don't cross the threshold, but they continue to use force at different levels, which belies this argument of, you know, China being essentially a peaceful actor. But then again, it's legitimate for states to make those rhetorical arguments. It's important for people to look at them with deep skepticism.
Yeah, I think it's only fair to not blame China alone in this. Every other country is looking after its strategic interests. Okay, Manoj, last question to you. So Zhao Liji, in his speech at Bo, said that something like the world is in tatters and the global economy has been the doldrums and should jointly implement GDI, deepen mutually beneficial cooperation across the board. I'm curious to know if you can answer this. How exactly does GDI help? And now GDI has been projected by China as one of the alternative modernization path to other developing countries. It's still debatable how keen they are to force this on other countries, but I'm just curious to know, in China's GDI framework, how does it help? Are there any tools up China's sleeves that can help global economy recover? Are there any solutions that China's GDI framework has in this regard?
I don't think it's meant in that in the context of the overall global economy's recovery. I think it's meant in the context that, look, things are hard and things are likely to remain hard. GDI, which is targeted largely towards developing countries and is linked to the UN Sustainable Development Agenda. So the argument is that Zhao Liji seems to be making over there is that, look, despite things being difficult, the focus needs to remain on the developing world because they are facing the brunt of the challenges of a weak world economy. At the same time, we need to focus on sustainable development, and the GDI is a symbol of the Chinese approach to sustainable development under the UN Sustainable Development Goals Agenda, right? So that's the point that he's making, is that you need to be focusing on those goals. It's also a very nice indication that he's not committing big money, that China will not be committing big ticket infrastructure spending. China will not be doing anything heavy in that sense. It will be focusing on these small but beautiful initiatives rather than, you know, doing a lot more in terms of providing loose money to countries around the world. In fact, if you look at the speech, BRI is mentioned twice, and the only time that it is mentioned substantively is to talk about building synergy rather than any significant new commitments that he may be indicating at, right? So I think that's what the hint is, that look, there's not going to be a lot of money coming from China's way also, but we need to be focusing on elements of sustainable development while helping out the developing world, because the developing world is where China's overall diplomacy today is targeted, given that its views that region, that part of the world, you know, this broad sense of the developing world, as partners in terms of its competition with the United States.
Right. And if there was no real substance in the initiative, I think, I'm not sure if there was a need for a new initiative.
I'm glad there's no one new initiative. It's tiring.
Right. Thank you, Manoj. This has been a wonderful conversation. I think we covered a lot and almost all the signals that came out of these two conferences, and it was a wonderful conversation.
I think the one thing that we perhaps can, that I would, you know, perhaps I can mention as we end is the visit of this apparent delegation from the US, obviously not official. It was representatives of US strategic affairs, business and academic communities. I encourage anybody who's interested in how China sets the narrative to go and read out from Xinhua after these meetings and read how profusely Xinhua reports that these individuals praised Xi Jinping and his leadership, while at the same time read reports in Reuters, Financial Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, where these same leaders are anonymously quoted as saying, well, we don't necessarily have too much faith in how the Chinese economy is going to evolve. But it tells you a little bit about how much narrative setting is happening and how much, you know, the real numbers, however real they are important to track rather than just the narrative.
Okay. With that note to our listeners, we'll bring this to an end. Thank you, Manoj, for being here and talking about the two conferences.
Thanks so much.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.